Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Ben Sands. Ben is the founder of Sands Leadership, the developer of the Sands Value Assessment. He's a former ski instructor, and he teaches leaders how to build thriving businesses without burning out. And today we're going to engage in a wide-ranging and very interactive conversation on a number of topics, including the importance of balancing a risk-free and regret-free approach to leadership, alternatives for solving the accountability problem, techniques for overcoming four of the most common roadblocks leaders face, the importance of great decision-making hygiene, and why he believes it's likely more important to end with why than start with why. It's a great conversation. I'm excited to share it with you, and I really appreciate you all taking the time to join us today. Thank you. Before we dive into it, I want to thank our sponsors really fast. First, we have HumanTel. Please, for everybody who's interested in understanding what emotions are likely shifting when they see somebody's facial expressions or nonverbal communication change, head over to humantel.com. Select the self-paced online best-in-class training that you feel is right for you and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off of that training program. I highly recommend it. I've done it myself. Read their research, read their blogs, read their background. I can't recommend it enough. Head over to humantel.com for the training. For all of the professional interviewers who are listening, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about all of the networking, resources, online and in-person events, and more that are offered by the International Association of Interviewers. What's it take to be a member? All your questions will be answered there. That's also where you can dive into the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation, learn about some of the evolutions that are coming very soon for that program, understand what it takes to qualify, pass, maintain the designation, and learn more about what that designation might mean for you and your career moving forward. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs that our clients ask us to customize for their senior leadership teams, their sales teams, and their HR teams to teach them their persuasive and strategic observation and inquiry techniques to encourage people to share more truthful information to help make better decisions and build stronger relationships. You can find all that and more at inquasive.com. I really appreciate you all being here again. Thank you so much. Thank you, Ben, for taking the time and having such a wonderful conversation. And now, without further ado, I introduce to you Ben Sands. Good afternoon, Ben. It is so great to see you again. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
It's great to be here, Michael.
So I don't know a whole lot. We've spoken a couple of times before. I don't know a whole lot about your story and your past, but I do know that you had a very unique, unintentional, and unplanned journey from where you started to where you are today. And I know you got some really cool lessons from that. So I thought this would be a great place to start. Could you walk us through not only how you ended up where you are today, but some of the non-traditional lessons that you learned and still apply?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So the headline is that so much of what I do today is based on four formative years living and working in a ski town. That town specifically was Aspen, obviously sort of a name brand. But I got to Aspen in sort of a circuitous way. I graduated from college and I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And I had a formative conversation with a professor in my senior year of college, who gave me some advice that really resonated at the time. And he says, Ben, if you don't know what to do, do what you love. And his rationale was, if you do what you love, then you're going to do it well. And if you do things well, then the money will follow. And, you know, I pointed to himself as sort of a case in point. He loved teaching, and now he was sort of a famous professor at a great university. And so I really took that to heart. And I'm sitting there thinking, what do I really love? And unfortunately, at the time, I could only come up with three things. I liked reading books, I liked drinking beer, and I liked skiing, snow skiing. And so I couldn't figure out how to make that work. So long story short, I ended up doing what all my other friends did, which was move to New York City and got a job. And I was living and working in New York City. I loved New York, but didn't really love the work that I was doing. And I'd been there for about a year and a half. And at that point, I was given a gift. And this isn't going to sound necessarily like a gift, but it really was a gift in retrospect. And that gift was on the morning of September 11th, 2001, I was walking to work and an airplane flew right over my head. And moments later, it crashed into the Twin Towers. And so I was standing in the middle of Fifth Avenue with hundreds of other people just staring up and watching the towers as they started to tremble and fall. And Michael, as I remember it today, now 20 plus years later, I remember it as hearing a voice that said very loudly and clearly, "Ben, life is short and it is time to start living more intentionally." And so I sat there and thinking that the world had changed and I needed to change as a result. And I remember those words of my professor. And I said, "You know what? I'm going to go make this live what you do, live, you know, do what you love thing work." And so I quit my job 3 days later, packed up my car and moved west to Aspen in time for ski instructor tryouts. I was lucky enough to get the job. And over that period, you know, a lot of people say, "Gosh, you were a ski bum." And I'd say, yes, I was, in fact, living and working in a ski town. You might describe me as a ski bum. But the reality was very, very different. It was a highly, highly professional organization. You might imagine this is, you know, a big business, ski instruction in Aspen. And I was so grateful and so like fortunate to be trained by some of the most accomplished and thoughtful coaches in the world. And so many of the lessons that I learned on the ski slope have stuck with me to today. So I use the lessons learned in those formative years in Aspen every single day when I'm working with my clients. And I can explain in more detail what some of those lessons are. But it was a non-traditional start to what is now, you know, looks, acts, and feels a little bit more like a traditional career. But I'm very lucky to have had those experiences so early on in my life.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And I'm glad we didn't meet earlier when we both enjoyed drinking beer so much, or this conversation likely would have sounded quite different. And I do, in all seriousness, I love the non-traditional routes. I'm sure through your work, both inside and outside, you meet families with kids at different ages through sports or community or church or whatever it might be. And I hear people talking about their kids getting ready to go to college and what are they going to do and what's their career. And my story isn't nearly as dramatic as yours, but I don't have a traditional approach either. And when I listen to parents worrying about getting their child into a traditional approach, hey, that's great for a lot of people. It works for a lot of families. But I'm also sitting there saying, you know what? By taking the non-traditional approach, you get a lot of perspective and a lot of experience and ideas that can help you connect with other people and solve other problems in ways that aren't necessarily anticipated because of where it comes from. So I really appreciate you volunteering to break down some of those key lessons that you still apply in the work that you do with the executives and businesses that you support today. So if you don't mind, I would love it if you could break down some of those for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the first thing I want to say is, I did discover that my professor's advice, "Do what you love and the money will follow," was absolutely not true, right? That is terrible career advice, right? I just want to make that really clear. And it's kind of funny, Michael, because what happened is that first year, I skied over 100 days. I think I skied 113 days that season. And the fact of the matter was, by the end of that first season out there, I never wanted to ski again. I was so sick of skiing. And so, ironically, I'm sitting there in April of that year, and I'm feeling very sorry for myself because here it was, I had done the brave thing. I was, quote unquote, living the dream as far as my friends were concerned. But I had just followed my passion, living the dream. And here it was, like in April, really feeling lost and dejected. And in fact, probably even more lost and dejected than I had been in New York City in August of 2001, because in August, I always had in the back of my mind, if things get too bad here in New York City, I can break glass and move to Aspen, right? Now here, I'd just done the break glass. I'd moved to Aspen, but I didn't have a plan C. So interesting way things kind of came around. I don't know what to do. I'm feeling very lost, feeling very dejected. I end up picking up a ski magazine, right? Killing time. And I'm reading the ski magazine and to get to the very last page in the magazine. It's a one-page bio on this guy, right? And I read this article on this guy, and I'm like, wow, this guy has lived a life that I want to live. He has done the kinds of things that I want to do in my life. Turns out that this guy happened to be my boss. He was the CEO of the Aspen Ski Company, a guy named Pat O'Donnell. Now, he didn't know me and I didn't know him. I literally didn't even know he was the CEO of the company. But I did know that I had an intranet and I had access to his email. So I found his email, I looked him up, and lacking any better idea, Michael, I sent him a note and I said very simply, I just read this article. You've lived a life I aspire to emulate. I'd love to buy you a cup of coffee and ask you about what you were doing when you were my age, right? And I sent that email out. I had no expectation that, just no expectation that he would read it, and certainly no expectation that he'd reply. But he did just that. And within 15 minutes or so, he comes back to me and says, listen, thanks for the note. Don't worry about buying me a cup of coffee. Come in tomorrow morning. We'll make some coffee and we'll go from there. And, you know, long story short, Pat became an incredibly important mentor to me during that period of my life. And here's what I discovered, and it goes back to your idea about traditional versus non-traditional paths. When I was talking with Pat about what to do next, I kept bumping into this idea or just this fear that I was going to somehow screw up the gifts that I'd been given, right? That I wasn't going to live up to my potential, that I was going to somehow fritter away the opportunities that I had in front of me. And, you know, he's helping me think this through. And one day he comes in, he goes, Ben, I just had an epiphany. And, you know, I realized that you're thinking about this wrong, right? And I said, oh, how? Like, how am I thinking about this wrong? He said, well, you know, you're really obsessed with risk. And I was obsessed with risk and managing risk. You talk about risk a lot. He's like, but Ben, you don't want to live a risk-free life, right? A risk-free life is a life without growth. A risk-free life is a boring life. And he said, what I think you want instead is a regret-free life. A life where you don't wake up a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and look back and say, woulda, coulda, shoulda. And Michael, when he said that, it like hit me right in the chest, right? I'm like, yes, that is what I want, right? Because I'd always been a risk taker. I'd always been pursuing non-traditional paths. It was kind of weird that I was starting to get afraid and kind of come back to saying, hey, give me a more traditional path. That wasn't in my nature. What I wanted though is to that regret-free reality. And so anyway, I asked him, I said, Pat, so that sounds exactly right. How do I do that? And this is where it was funny. He's like, that's the easy part. I go, what do you mean the easy part? How do you do it? He goes, living a regret-free life is simply comes down to knowing who you are and specifically what you value. And then always, always, always taking decisions in alignment with those values. And so that set me off on a path, Michael, where I was really obsessed with better understanding what is a value. And how can I live more in line or congruently with those values, right? What is a value? What are my values? And how do I live in alignment with them? And so what I discovered is that once with this new frame, now I could recreate my Aspen life in a manner that was much more consistent with my values. I could create a life in this ski town that still felt professional. And like I were moving forward and making progress, both personally and professionally. And that just changed my whole outlook and changed the whole Aspen experience. So as I mentioned before, I spent 4 years full time in Aspen. And those were four of the most formative, you know, greatest years of my early life there. So again, I can come back to what happened in Aspen. I just wanted to like put that like little bit of color around how that experience really shaped not just practically what I do professionally, but also just really the way I looked at the world. And I continue to operate with something of a regret minimizing decision-making framework, where I'm constantly living and endeavoring to live and work in perfect alignment with what I most value.
I really appreciate you sharing that. And kudos to you for making your own mentorship opportunity. Back then it wasn't, I guess you could argue if it's harder or easier now, depending on perspective, but the means of communication wasn't as easy back then as it is now. Like, yes, you had email, but you didn't have social media. So it was harder to track people, follow people, maybe even say stalk people in order to build those opportunities. So for you to go out of your way to create that relationship opportunity yourself was a big win and something to be emulated there. And I do love the idea, or the concept of risk-free versus regret-free. And it's certainly for me, that regret or not regret battle is one that I've fought countless times. And I don't know that I can put a finger on how many I've won or lost, but certainly a battle that I've fought. And even for me, sometimes it just comes down to, if I'm going to regret it, would I rather regret doing it or not doing it? And then if it comes down at least to that, if this doesn't work, would I rather regret it, trying it and have it not working? Or would I rather regret not doing it and never knowing? And I know that's not like evolved decision-making, but I mean, for me, sometimes that's just as far as I can get with it. But with your offer to go back to Aspen there, and earlier you mentioned like understanding what a value is. Mm-hmm. So values get tossed around a lot. Know your values, stay true to your values, align your organization to your values, align your business to your values. But there could very well be some ambiguity around what truly constitutes a value and then how to align our decisions with that. So as you go back to Aspen, if you feel that's the best place to go, I would love if you could walk us through from your experience, what constitutes a value? And then what are some of the best ways for us as individuals and organizations to stay aligned with those, especially during the challenging moments?
Oh, absolutely. So one, just a fine point on regret and risk, regret-free and risk-free. There is no such thing as risk-free, right? Because there's a whole bunch of stuff in the world that's just out of our control, right? So you can take a decision that is regret-free that doesn't work out, right? That may not pan out the way you want it or hope it will, right? And that's just the reality of life and decision-making in a world full of both opportunity and uncertainty. Right. The regret-free element is that you can look back and say, based on the information I had at the time, right, I wouldn't have made a different decision, even if that decision didn't ultimately turn out to be the absolute best case scenario. So my guess, you're thinking about this right, Michael, based on what I hear. And we know from longitudinal studies of human beings and, you know, when asked to reflect on what they regret most and why, it is always, always the things that they didn't do, right? Much more so than the things that they did do that didn't work out. So I think you're on the right path in terms of thinking this through, and just keep that in mind. We regret more the things that we don't do than those that we do, even if they don't work out as planned.
I appreciate the self-esteem bump on that one. Thank you.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is one of the biggest challenges of leadership. And you know, when I think about, you know, I'm often asked, well, you're a leadership development expert, a coach, like what is leadership? I always say like, there's a variety of different characteristics and capabilities that are associated with leadership. But at the end of the day, the thing that really truly differentiates or distinguishes a leader from everybody else is the necessity to make the decision, right? To decide the path forward amid this environment of both great opportunity and great uncertainty. At the end of the day, the leader's the guy or gal that says, here's the direction, here's where we're going, right? And all the other stuff, you know, communication, trust building, having hard conversations, strategic thinking, those can be done by other people in the organization, right? Certainly the leader needs to have those capabilities and will be a more effective leader if he or she is good in these areas. But at the end of the day, the leader gets paid to make the call. And so decision-making and the ability to make consistently good decisions amid conditions of uncertainty and opportunity, in my mind, that is the preeminent leadership skill. And that's where, you know, I spend a lot of my time thinking and working with clients, how to improve their ability to make consistently good decisions over time. That brings us to values, because again, what is a consistently good decision? Well, if you don't have a crystal ball, right, then you can't evaluate a decision based on the ultimate outcome, right? You want to evaluate the decision on the quality of the decision-making process, right? Sometimes people make a bad decision, but they just get lucky, right? And so we focus really on how do you create good decision-making hygiene? And that's, again, where values come in, both personally and at a corporate, in a corporate setting. So, Michael, let me ask you, if I had to ask, you know, imagine you're trying to explain what is a value, how would you define a value? And I'm putting you on the spot, but trust me, there's no right or wrong answer here. But just curious, like, if I asked you, like, you know, Michael, explain to me, what is a value? How would you explain that? How would you describe value?
No, definitely put me on the spot. And I appreciate you saying no right or wrong answer, but I bet I could find a wrong one if you gave me enough time to think about it. I would say a value is, and here's where I get, like, am I using the same word, but just phrasing it differently? A value would be a strong belief or a principled belief that should guide our decision-making process, because I'm going to use the word believe again as I get put on the spot and make this up, but it's that strong belief that helps us navigate the decision-making process, because it's tied, I would assume, both to our self-image and the outcome that we're trying to achieve.
Not bad. Yeah, that sounds pretty darn good, man. Here's the thing, right? This word is so commonly misunderstood. And I think you did a great job of defining value. And I'll give you my definition in just a second. But one of the biggest, you know, underappreciated challenges in any organization, especially when it comes to communication, right? And really communicating well, is a lack of alignment or common lexicon within a given organization, right? Imagine you and I both get hired by Acme Corporation. And Acme Corporation is a really big values-driven enterprise. Well, if you and I, maybe we come in at senior, you know, in two different senior leadership roles, right? If you and I aren't ever coached or taught what how Acme defines what a value is, well, you and I are going to be naturally operating under the assumption that we have the same definition of value, and our definition of value is the same as the CEO's and everybody else in that senior leadership team. The fact is, that's rarely the case. And this it's not just for a word like value. Words like goals, strategy, KPIs, targets, OKRs, right? These are all words that we learn. Like, we generally understand what these words mean, but the specific definition will depend on essentially where we grew up professionally, right? Maybe where we went to business school, for some who have gone to business school. But a lot of times we learn these sort of organically through our earliest jobs. And it's really important in every organization to pressure test the language that we're using, especially from a strategy execution perspective. And it's one of the first things I do in a client organization is just make sure that we're all speaking the same language. And the word value is a great example where most people have a loose understanding of what a value is, but don't have enough clarity on what that word means to really use it as it's intended, and ultimately to create the kind of values-driven culture that they're after. So here's values 101. Best definition of value, the most intuitive definition of value that I've ever seen, came from Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, who defined a value simply as a value is what you value, right? Or in the context of Netflix, our values are what we value. That really resonated with me, Michael. I said, huh, yeah, of course, right? It's what we value, right? Specifically a value, and this would include words like, you know, all the good ones, honesty, trust, kindness, achievement, success, empathy, right? These are all different forms of values. A value is a principle, standard, or belief that guides our decision-making and behavior. So you nailed that. The other important part of the definition is that our values also influence our evaluation or interpretation of the decisions and behavior of others, right? We judge people and their behavior through the lens of our values, right? So values, what they manifest as behavior, it's what we do and what we don't do, right? If we value achievement, for example, right? We may get up early in the morning to get as much done as possible. We may exercise consistently. We may never go to bed without an empty inbox, right? that's the how the achievement value might manifest. And of course, that's there's other values mixed in there as well. But our values are best embodied or defined by our behavior, right? What we do and what we don't do. And that's one of the things that I love talking about and thinking about is the gap between what we say we value, right? Those values that we identify as being valuable to us and how we're living our lives, right? The gap between our aspirational values and our values by behavior. And so that's something that I love thinking about and talking about. I've even created an assessment to help people identify that gap between what they say they value and how they're actually operating both personally and professionally. And folks listening to the podcast can go to sansvalues.com and gain access to that assessment for free. I'm such a believer in the importance of understanding what you value and why, that I just make that tool available to anybody who's who's similarly interested in better understanding themselves.
Well, that's awesome, man. Thank you very much. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes for sure. I appreciate you sharing that. And I love how you talk about that gap. You know, what do you say your values are? What are the standards that you're living towards? How do those equal out? And I had to chuckle a little bit inside when you went through the list of the common values. And the first one was honesty. It's almost everybody's first one, right? We value honesty, trust, truth, transparency, all of these things. But then I start working with, much like you, I start working with CEOs, senior leaders, whoever. And one of the first things they'll do is they'll tell me how mad they are at somebody who they perceived to have lied to them and violated one of their values. And then when you start breaking it down, it's like, well, if honesty is so important, what are we doing to create an environment where people feel comfortable being honest? If we value it, are we creating an environment where people can do it? Or are we inciting fear that pushes people further away from it? And then, by the way, if we don't get exactly what we want exactly when we want it, are we assuming people are lying to us? Or are we stopping for a moment to consider the fact that they're afraid of something? Therefore, they're, if you will, massaging or couching or coding their answer in a way that they feel like satisfies the questioner, but then protects them from whatever it is they're afraid of as well. So I feel like your point about what you say you believe in versus how you're behaving and the environment you're creating or can be, unfortunately, sometimes two very different things. So if you don't mind taking a minute, I don't want to take away from your values assessment, but if there are a couple of things that you really work with people to hone in on closing that gap between what they aspire to and how they behave, I'd be thrilled if you could share it with us.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of cool things that you just touched on. So one, frustration, right? A lot of folks listening to this podcast have felt, I would say everybody listening to this podcast has felt frustrated about something at some point in the last
15 minutes.
15 minutes, right? Yeah, I was going to say 24 hours. Frustration and values go hand in hand, right? When you feel frustration, now I want you to think about that frustration, that emotional response, the feeling of frustration as a signal that something you value is not being valued in this moment. Frustration is a perfect signal of value, right? So in that case where the CEO is feeling frustrated, right? Because this person has not been honest, right? It's a sign or signal to the CEO that he or she values honesty. Now, I don't think honesty, that's a different topic. Honesty is not a very useful corporate value, right? Because if I say, hey, you know, Michael, I don't like the color shirt you're wearing. You know, I'm being honest, but not really. I think it's a lovely shirt, but that's not what you're looking for at the executive level. So honesty is a very tricky sort of word. And when you dig into it, again, this is where like you got to have a definition of values so that you can say, well, what do we really value? Or what do we value even more than honesty, right? Well, I value respect more than honesty, right? I don't necessarily want to know everything that you're thinking and feeling. I would want you to communicate whatever you're thinking and feeling in a, sure, an honest, open, and transparent way, but also, and most importantly, in a respectful way, right? And this is how you would start to think about what your core values are, right? There's lots of good values out there in the world, Michael. I've done this research. There's about 200 plus words reflecting values. And this is where values discovery exercises, these things that, you know, companies endeavor to do to discover or define their company core values, this is where they go wrong, because they put a list of these 200 words on the wall or the whiteboard and say, hey, which ones do you like best? Right. And it's literally like a pick and choose kind of exercise. And that's not terribly helpful, because they're all good. Right. And, you know, if you value everything, right. In other words, we value all these things. Right. But if you value everything, you value nothing. And no organization, no team, no individual values everything the same way. So we all have our own core values, which are the smaller set of values that we personally, and then as an organization, prioritize, right? The most important values. And that's how we start to think about closing the gap. When you get frustrated, though, I want to introduce an idea that I think will resonate with your audience. And that's called the happiness equation. The happiness equation is very simple, Michael. It can help anybody who's feeling frustrated in a leadership environment manage that frustration and turn it into constructive action. The happiness equation is very simply R equals E. You are happy when R equals E. Michael, you want to guess, take a shot at what R and E stand for?
Reality equals expectations.
There it is. Look at you.
Fantastic. I swear I didn't cheat. Yeah. You didn't tell me that before.
No. It's great. Well, that, and it's because it's intuitive. I mean, not to say that that wasn't a very smart answer, but it's intuitive too, right? Like reality equals expectations. I'm happy when what is happening right now is consistent with what I expected to happen right now, right? So when that CEO is frustrated, the happiness equation is out of balance, right? R is not equaling E. So when I'm coaching a leader in that situation, as much as they want me to jump in and say, oh my gosh, you're right, I can't believe that person did X, Y, and Z, my first question as coach is very simple. What was your expectation in that situation? What did you expect this person to do? And often if they're still emotionally charged up, they'll say, not that, right? So anything other than that, and say, okay, you're great. But like, talk me through it. Like, what exactly would you have expected that person to do? And they'll be able to articulate it. I mean, they have an expectation somewhere. Now, the second question, right? Once they've identified the expectation, the second question really gets a cross look from a client. And that is, Michael, did you ever share that expectation with this person? Now, you want to guess what's the most common reaction that a client would give me? What's that?
I shouldn't have to.
Amen. I mean, you've done this before, my friend, right? I shouldn't have to. Or they should already know that, right? Yeah. Or they should have known that, right?
Either some way, variation same coin, different this. Side.
Exactly. And now we've just uncovered the number one blind spot of almost every leader I've ever worked with. Not every leader that I've worked with. The number one blind spot of most leaders. And it is an implicit assumption that they will never articulate verbally. But it goes something like this. If everybody in the organization were a little bit more like me, we wouldn't be having the problems we're having right now. Right? They should have known. Right? I know. They should know. And this is just a great opportunity for most leaders. Right? When you're experiencing a disconnect between the behavior or performance of your organization today and the behavior and performance of the organization that you expect to be achieving today, right? First thing you can do is one, clarify what your expectation is. And second, communicate and reinforce that expectation. It takes so much of the uncertainty and ambiguity out of that environment. Right. And as a result, so much of the frustration that you're feeling and the fear and trepidation likely that your team is feeling, because so many times they're operating without real clarity and understanding about what the boss wants. Right. So this is where values come back in. Right. As leader, you need to understand what your values are, because your values are shaping your expectations, and you need to be able to proactively share those values and the related expectations with your colleagues so that you can avoid any kind of unintended, misalignment or miscommunication.
I love it. I have two choices. I can either say amen or spend the next 15 minutes reiterating what you just said with somewhat different language. So I'm going to go with amen. I love everything that you just said. And for me, one of the brightest call outs or most obvious call outs to that is I have a young son, and more frequency than I wish, I will ask him to do something and he will do something else. He's not disobeying me. He's not ignoring me. He's not resisting. He's doing what he thought I asked him to do. And so I have to be smart enough before I, you know, discipline or respond or do something to my son to be like, oh, I wasn't clear enough. He's doing what he thought I asked him to do. So I can either educate him, like I can thank him or congratulate or support what he's doing because he's doing what he thought I asked. Then I can redirect him towards what I wanted him to do, or I can now go do it myself because I didn't explain it right the first time. And I can't punish Gabe for him misinterpreting something that I wasn't clear about. So I love everything that you just explained.
Just as a father of five children, I think this is also a great application to parenting. Whether we realize it or not, we often evaluate our efficacy and success as a parent by our ability to imbue in our children what we most value. And it can be a very powerful source of frustration and anxiety in our life if our children operate in a manner that is inconsistent with what we most value. And so again, values awareness, understanding that, you know, I don't think there's a parent out there that hasn't been or will ever, you know, not be frustrated with their children, right? That's just part of the parenting, right? And so much of it is our own, you know, we're being frustrated with ourselves for not being very good at parenting, even if we're just brand new to it. But, you know, my wife and I work very hard. And one of the things we did early on in our parenting journey is to sit down and agree on what values do we most want our children to embody and model when they are leaving our home. And this is a nice proxy for like what company core values really are, right? The true or real company core values or core values of your company are the aggregate personal core values of everybody who works for that company, right? Because again, the real core values are just basically what the company does or doesn't do. It's the real core values are show up in the behavior of the organization. It doesn't matter what's on the wall or the website, right? It's all about the behavior. And so if you think about that in the context of a family, right? And, you know, husband and wife, the spouses or partners, they are co-CEOs of that family unit, of that family business. And both husband and wife had their own set of personal core values. So that's why I can't say, hey, honey, the values of this family are X, Y, and Z, because the reality is those aren't her values. We share a lot of similar values. It's why we got married, why we were attracted to each other in the first place, why we're still married 12 years later. But they're not exactly the same. And so together we have to come and say, hey, what are the values that we most want our children to have? We identified three as a couple, and we incorporate those values and reinforce those values in everything that we do. And it really helps to align us both in terms of, you know, how we're communicating, how we're coaching the kids, but also, you know, how we reward or punish certain behavior or performance, right? And what we celebrate and what we choose to not celebrate. So big thing, I think, a big opportunity for a lot of parents that's got direct relevance in comparison to leading an organization, which is, you know, the more you understand yourself, the more you understand what your values are and where they come from, right? Why you value what you value, the easier it is to set expectations with others and ultimately to work better together. And again, both professionally and personally, it seems to hold true.
I couldn't agree more once again, and probably because of just the stage that I am in life. One of the reasons why I love the non-traditional story at the beginning of the conversation is because, you know, where I am right now, I'm raising a young son and I coach a lot of youth sports. Now there's a cap to that. There's only so many more seasons I can coach before he's going to need a more qualified coach. But I was recently asked during a program where I was working with a group of senior executives where I learned to keep a group of CEOs in line. And without missing a beat, I turned around and said, coaching T-ball. And some people laughed and some people looked at me like I was trying to be offensive and I wasn't. It's astonishingly similar trying to keep a group of 5 and 6 year olds in line to try to keep a bunch of CEOs in line. There's people might be surprised if they stop and broke it down, how many things those two groups have in common. So I love the analogy to the parenting there as well. You mentioned expectations. You've mentioned alignment, values. One of the topics that I feel like runs hand in hand to all of this is accountability. And I'm sure you hear it at least as much, if not more than I do, holding people accountable, keeping people accountable. We're a high accountability organization. People need to be accountable to their words, their actions. But I feel like there's a gap in how we hold people accountable that's similar to the gap within how we identify and live out or behave through our values. Am I close to that? And if I am, how do you see it playing out?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, again, it's another sign of frustration, right? This is another that manifests as a, you know, how are you feeling about this? I'm feeling frustrated, right? People, there's a lack of accountability here. People aren't doing what they said they were going to do. People aren't, you know, delivering on time or on budget. It's another, you know, more often than not, that statement is going to be complemented with an emotion of frustration. So that's good. Again, another signal, something that I value is not being valued. Now, the question is, what do I value? What, you know, accountability, is accountability a value? Yeah, it is. The word that I use, the term that incorporates the value of accountability in my values assessment is responsibility, right? We value responsibility. People who value accountability value responsibility. Meaning people who, you know, I take ownership for my actions. I own the outcomes. I don't make excuses. I don't blame others. These are all behaviors associated with that value of responsibility. So again, if you're a CEO who's feeling frustrated by a lack of accountability, first thing first is just recognize that, this is about you, right? You value accountability or, you know, responsibility. That's important to know, important to understand, because the more you articulate, hey, this is why I feel so strongly about us or you as an individual or us as a team behaving this way, is because I take responsibility really seriously, right? Responsibility is an incredibly important value to me, right? And this is a behavior that reflects responsibility. So the values are what's going on here. Now, how do you solve the accountability problem? I love talking about this because I think it's actually a lot easier to solve than most people think. More often than not, right, a lack of accountability is just a symptom of an underlying lack of clarity. A lack of accountability is a symptom of an underlying lack of clarity. Now, I mean, I want to give your folks one of the most useful frameworks that I use in my coaching program. And that is what I call the roadblocks, right? So imagine there's a gap between the performance of the team today and the performance that you're expecting, right? And an expectation gap. Whenever there's a gap like that, there's one of five roadblocks that are cropping up. The first is a lack of clarity. We don't know what we want or why we want it, right? There's two elements to the clarity roadblock, but a lack of clarity. We don't know what we want or why we want it. The second roadblock is a lack of or the wrong strategy. We don't know what to do or how to do it. Three, a mindset block. We don't believe we can or want to do what we have to do, right? Four, what I call the whirlwind. I got this term from Stephen Covey or the Franklin Covey organization in their great book, The Four Disciplines of Execution. The whirlwind, we can have perfect clarity, a great strategy, a winning mindset, but we don't have any space to actually get the work done, right? The whirlwind is all the urgent stuff that crowds out the space and time we need to do whatever it is that we know we can and want and need to do. And then the fifth roadblock is one we've talked about already. And that is sort of the evergreen challenge, which is the alignment challenge. You can have all those other roadblocks covered and then the world changes, right? World war erupts, a pandemic emerges, right? The stock market crashes, right? Whatever that is, right? Now you got to kind of restart. Clarity, strategy, mindset, whirlwind. How do we manage all of that in this new world that we're operating in? The fact is those big things, thanks be to God, only happen occasionally. but there are little shifts in the ground every single day. And so we always, as leaders, have to be mindful of maintaining alignment. That's one of our number one jobs. So going back to this accountability question, right? Here's how we coach somebody through it. Number one, your lack of accountability, was it clear what specifically this person was supposed to do and by when, right? And clarity is not just on your end, right? It's clarity on their end. It goes back to your son, right? It was clear to me, but apparently I did not adequately clarify that to him, right, in that situation. So a lot of accountability can be cleaned up just by reinforcing and clarifying what is the commitment. What specifically are you committing to do by when, right? And that takes out a lot of the accountability issues. But then there's a strategy element to it, right? If we're having that conversation, hey, Michael, what are you committing to doing by when? As you and I are walking out the door off to another meeting, right? You've done your best to create clarity, but strategically, that's a bad plan, right? Because it's not likely that person is going to be able to write it down, get it into their calendar, make it happen, right? So tactically and strategy, when I think about the what to do and how to do it, some people might call that the tactical application of this. There's a weakness there. So how do I do that, right? And this is where, well, I'll spend a lot of time working with leaders about how to run a better weekly team meeting where you've got time blocked in that agenda for everyone to make commitments, to clarify those commitments, and to put those commitments in their calendar before they walk out the door. And that little extra step, Michael, when someone makes a commitment and then immediately goes and puts time on the calendar to execute on that commitment, increases the probability that they're going to follow through by about 80%, right? Very, very simple tactical change with a massive impact on how likely it is that people actually keep their commitments. Mindset, right? That starts at the leader level, but you know, stories like I don't have time to do this, or I don't think this is as important as I, you know, once did, or CEO's never going to check up on this. He doesn't really care about this that much, right? These are the stories, the mindset issues that will hold us back from following through and creating a high accountability culture. And then of course, you have the whirlwind, which is all the other stuff that's crowding in on us, making it hard to create the space and time we need to do these things, right? And you know, a lot of time, you know, it was just session with a leadership team, and the CFO had failed to keep his commitment. And you know, we get in there and we're doing an accountability check-in, and he's like, I didn't do what I said, but it's because payroll, you know, our payroll got out of whack, right? And you know, to the CEO's credit, he said, you know, because we've been working on this. He said, okay, talk me through, like, when did the payroll go get out of whack? And he's like, well, you know, just yesterday, right? And so the CEO is clarifying to the CEO. He goes, so let me just make this, you know, just to clarify, this commitment that you've had on, you know, known about for a week, you had committed to, you know, you had planned to do it, you know, within 24 hours of when the deadline was, right? And yeah, I mean, the CFO immediately, you know, and very graciously said, that's bad planning. Yeah. And again, the follow-up is very simple. So what are you going to do differently next week? And of course, the CFO's comment was, I'm going to make time on the calendar in the next 24 hours to get this done, right? And yet, this isn't rocket science. These are things that most executives already know, but, you know, I've learned in my life and career, Michael, that most leaders need to be reminded far more often than they need to be taught, but they need to be reminded, right? It's not nothing to remind a leader about an age-old principle that's directly applicable to something, to a challenge that they're facing, even if that leader has somewhere else heard or learned that principle in a different context. So anyway, so accountability, high accountability cultures, you want to solve that. It's a, you know, sort of a four-step process. Clarify, develop a better strategy, address the mindset issues, and be cognizant of the whirlwind.
Once again, I love it. And I appreciate the step-by-step breakdown there. Thank you. And for me, I had to chuckle a little bit when you mentioned the I didn't have time, a lesson that I had to learn the hard way in a way that honestly I still have to keep myself in check sometimes. is anytime I think I didn't have time, the reality is I didn't think it was valuable enough to make the time. Because we're all busy. And if my son needs something, as soon as we end this conversation, I'm dropping my plans for the rest of the day. I'm going to go take care of it because my son is that valuable. If it was valuable enough, I would have made the time to have done it. So here now we're bringing that value concept back 360 again as we move towards the end of the conversation. We've talked a lot today about the accountability, the expectations, the alignment, a lot of processes. How do we work through these things? How do we close the gaps? Actions. How do our actions and behaviors really serve as emblems to what we truly believe? So on and so forth. So much that I've truly enjoyed. But I want to quickly wrap in an article that I saw you write online, which I think kind of works in here, where you talked about the dangers of starting with why. As a lot of people say, start with why. And I thought you wrote a very interesting and thought-provoking article on working towards ending with why. I'm paraphrasing, not trying to put words in your article, as opposed to starting with it. And what I love about this conversation is, without any of the listeners knowing that I had this question in my back pocket, you've really talked through the importance of starting with the what's and working back to the why, as opposed to starting with the why. So I would be grateful if you didn't mind taking a couple of minutes and just filling in the gaps in my oversummarization there as to why that philosophy is so important for you.
Yeah. And it's not that it's so important for me. I think the title of that article was "Start with Why is Bad Advice." It's kind of like the follow your passion is bad advice, right? This is lesson learned the hard way. You don't want to start with why, you want to finish with why. Why is that? Because of those clarity issues, first and foremost. When you're dealing with a group of people, you don't want to operate under the assumption that the whys will be aligned. It's almost impossible to find one single unifying why for a group of anything more than three people, right? Maybe two. I would say, like in your marriage, perhaps, hopefully, right? You can start with why, or right? There's a unifying why. But whenever you're involving multiple people, it becomes very, very challenging to create one single unifying why. And that, you know, that lack of alignment creates frustration, right? And, you know, people start telling the internal story, hey, my values aren't reflected in this why, right? Or my opinion isn't being heard. So the why matters, right? Because there's an emotional resonance and a key element of resilience that comes from having a clear understanding of why we are doing this thing in the first place. But when I'm, you know, working with leaders, helping them to create clarity and alignment across their organization, we prefer to start with the what and the how, right? What is specifically the outcomes, the impact and the outcomes that we are trying to create in the next 3 years. Another just massive opportunity for most organizations, most teams, is to clarify their longer term vision. Now, again, vision is another word. We mentioned these at the outset that most people have a general understanding of what it means, but it often means very different things in different organizations. So when I'm working with teams, first thing we do is we define vision as a very clear and compelling description of the specific impact and outcomes that we are trying to create in 3 years' time. And, you know, people say, well, why 3 years? Why not 5 or 10 or 20? And I have a very, you know, discrete or concrete reason for choosing 3 years. 3 years, a three-year time horizon, is a long enough or a large enough amount of time to make many big things happen, right? You think about the growth of your podcast between today and the end of 2027, right? This thing could be on a rocket ship by then, right? But, right, it's a long enough time to do a lot of things, but it's a short enough time such that if you're going to do these big things, you're going to have to get started now. And that's why I like 3 years. And, you know, the default is probably 5 years, but I always think, like, there's nothing in our life that operates on a five-year time cycle, right? The longest cycle most of us are used to is 4 years. That's high school and college, right? So 5 years, by virtue of the fact that it's five, when all we're used to is four, gives us a year to fiddle around, kind of build up some momentum to start executing on this vision. But of course, as you know, a year later, that vision may feel obsolete or, you know, not quite right anymore. It's a virtuous and violent negative cycle when you get people into these like strategy exercises. So forget that. 3 years and make it really clear and precise about the impact and the outcomes that you're trying to create. Once you've got that in place, now we can think about the how, right? How do we get there? We're at point A. How do we get to point B? What specific milestones or stage gates do we need to achieve or attain? How specifically are we going to execute on this vision? And then, but before we leave that strategy session, now we want to end with why, right? And this is, now that we've looked at this and we've like charted the path, let's make sure that this is a mindset check. Why does this matter, right? Why is this worth doing? Now that we're looking at this, why are we going to commit to following through and executing on this, right? And that's why, you know, I encourage people to have a personal why at that point. You don't need a collective team why, right? But I need you, Michael, I need you, Ben, to look at this strategy and tell me why it matters to you, right? I'm not going to try to generate, you know, a single why that resonates with everybody. What I really care is that it resonates with you for your own specific reason. And this is where personal values often come into play, right? Why does the execution of the strategy, you know, make sense to you, align with who you are, what you really want, and what you most value, right? We all need to be able to tell ourselves a story when we walk through the doors or sit down at our virtual office every single day, that we are exactly where we need to be, doing exactly what we need to do in order to get exactly where we want to go personally and professionally. That's really the secret to highest levels of engagement and performance. And this is, again, just an opportunity in so many organizations because we try to create these lofty, grand visions in the organization. But all we're doing there is saying, hey, in the absence of your own clarity, take on ours, right? Try this on for size. And that can work for a time, right? But far more powerfully is to give your team, every person working with and for you, the ability to clarify that for themselves, right? And then to be able to tell that story themselves. So that's why I think start with why is bad advice, much better advice to finish with why.
It summed it up quickly, but the points that you hit, the reasons behind them all make total sense. I appreciate it. And talk about outcomes. The outcome that I was looking to achieve from this and all of our conversation was an education-packed episode with examples and points that people could take away and apply right now. And man, I couldn't write them all down. You hit so many in the conversation we had today. I really appreciate all that you shared with us. Thank you so much. I know for a fact there's people listening right now that are saying to themselves, I need to learn more from Ben. And I know you mentioned the sans values previously. We'll add that. But for people who are looking to learn more from you, connect with you, potentially engage with you, where should they go?
My website is the best place, sansleadership.com. You know, I have a very simple product offering. My core thing that I do is take teams, usually intact teams, through an 8-week performance coaching bootcamp where you learn together as a team the many of the same, you know, principles and concepts that we've just talked about today, but most importantly, start to apply those principles and concepts directly to the real world issues and opportunities that you're facing as a team. So it's a really fun, high impact coaching engagement. And if folks are interested, they can learn more on my website, sansleadership.com.
I will certainly include those links. I cannot thank you enough for taking the time today, for all the lessons and techniques that you shared. Thank you so very much. It was great to see you again. I look forward to hopefully continuing this conversation soon. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Michael, thank you. Take care. Okay.
Ben, thank you so much for such a great conversation. I appreciate all of the ideas that you shared, all of the concepts you presented, the questions you asked me. I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you very much. And of all the things that you said, the importance of leaders being decisive, both in the face of uncertainty and opportunity, I thought rose right to the top of the list. I also love the thought that often when we're frustrated, that really is an indication that something we value doesn't appear to be valued by others in the moment. And I also love your thought that our values shape our expectations. So many great nuggets in such a short conversation. Ben, I can't thank you enough. I truly appreciate it. And of course, we'll share the link to that assessment that you mentioned as well. Thank you. And thank you to everybody who listened to that conversation and hopefully just like me, was taking notes throughout the dialogue as well. Thank you. Before we get out of here, we want to thank our sponsors again real quick. Please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off of their best-in-class online training to understand what it likely means when people's emotions are changing based on the facial expressions and nonverbal communications you observe. Like I keep saying, I've done it myself. I highly recommend it. Please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INCLUSIVE25 to start your training. For the professional interviewers, please head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That is where you can learn more about the benefits of membership, the networking opportunities, the online and in-person educational opportunities, the legal updates, so much more. Everything you need to know about the membership there. Also, that's where you can learn about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What's coming down the road? What does it take to qualify, earn, and maintain the designation? And what it might mean for your career and your next steps? All of that and more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the customized programs our clients ask us to facilitate for their senior leadership teams, sales teams, and HR teams, to teach them the strategic and ethical observation and persuasion techniques necessary for encouraging people to share more sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. All that and more at inquasive.com. I can't thank you all enough for continuing to listen and watch these conversations. Thank you so much. Please like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show, let your friends know about it. Leave us your feedback. What would you like to hear more or less of? We'd love to deliver that for you. Well, deliver more of what you'd like more of is what we'd like to deliver more for you. But we really appreciate you taking the time to be here. Thank you so much. Stay safe. Take care of each other. And we'll see you next time.